This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The war in Yemen has claimed many lives through bombing and starvation. Yet there is another component of the war that is getting even less attention: how refugees from Ethiopia and Somalia and other nations are risking their lives to board boats and cross the Yemen Sea to arrive in the chaotic war-torn nation seeking jobs in neighboring Gulf states. That phenomenon was highlighted recently when an estimated 150 refugees were, quote, deliberately drowned by smugglers, according to a UN agency, the International Organization for Migration. Most of those on board are very young, less than 18 years old. Many bodies have washed up on shore and been buried on the beach, but dozens of people are still missing. My guest is Joel Millman. He is the press officer at the Department of Media and Communications at the International Organization for Migration. He now joins me. Welcome to the program, Joel.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So can you first explain what exactly has been happening over the past week? We're getting very little news about these refugees being thrown overboard. Who are the refugees and what do you know about why they were cast off the boats they were on?
Well, let's clarify. Refugees is what I would call them if they were leaving Yemen, if they were war victims trying to get off the peninsula. They probably were migrants en route to the Gulf petro economies, you know, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Qatar, Kuwait, places where there continues to be high demand for the kind of low-cost labor that Africans represent in those societies. We've been seeing this now for quite some time, right from Ethiopia, Somalia, through Djibouti, even sometimes Eritrea and Sudan, crossing the Horn of Africa to get to the Middle East for work. We understand that somebody hesitated to call him a smuggler because it might have been one of the migrants who was getting a discount to work as a guide or to operate a motor on a boat. But somebody panicked and ordered everybody on the boat, there are at least two boats that we know of, into the surf. There are quite a number of survivors. We know of at least 22 that we talked with, but there are at least 70 people we believe dead. 39, I believe the remains of 39 people have been spotted. 31 are considered missing based on the testimony of those we talked with.
So when you cast them as migrants rather than refugees, what are the pressures that are driving this migration? Just so we can understand whether this is an ongoing thing or are these people basically, was this sort of a one-off type travel that these folks were engaged in?
No, it's certainly not a one-off. I mean, this is a very deadly route. It's even known as the Bab al-Mad, the gateway of grief. In local dialects, it's a choke point on the Red Sea that literally has been a migration route since the dawn of time. And when you imagine mankind came out of East Africa and traveled to the rest of the world, I mean, this is exactly the route that they went on. We have some complicating factors in 2017, one of which is a two-year-old war in Yemen, which the smugglers market to people looking for work as an opportunity to arrive undetected. There's the belief that the authorities won't stop them. We know this isn't true, and a lot of times people are in worse conditions because they are detected and then they're held in detention in very difficult conditions by one of two entities that are contesting for power in Yemen now. But plus there's landmines and there's snipers and there's gunfire and terrible things happen to migrants. But many of them are told that this is a great time to try to get to the richer economies on the other side of the peninsula and start working. And of course, many of them have already worked several times in these countries. What they would like, and I think what IOM would like, is to see more of a rotational migration system where people can go back and forth and fill jobs for which there's great demand and not have to live secretly or underground because they're afraid to leave with the fear that they won't be able to come back or they're afraid of being punished for being there without documents. And of course, we see this as the most extreme punishment of all, of trying to get back to work. We know that hundreds or tens of thousands of people have taken advantage of an amnesty to leave and go back to their countries without penalty. But then, of course, once they're there, they want to go back and earn, and they can only come back to these jobs by doing the kinds of risky things that these people did this week, and of course, paying the ultimate price.
So it's primarily economic pressures that is behind this kind of migration. And it sounds like you're saying there's repeated migration. I mean, I'm thinking of the US-Mexico border where there is traffic on in both directions often.
Yeah, there's a good analogy there. I mean, I tell people, and I've been covering migration quite a long time, that most people in the world want two things from migrants. They want them to come and do their work cheaply and efficiently and cheerfully, jobs that very few people in those countries will do happily. But they want them to leave, and they get upset when they don't leave fast enough, or they become costly, or they have children, or they have medical expenses that are deemed a cost of these workers. So the sticking point is they don't leave, they do come, and then they get punished for not leaving, which punishes those who want to come again. So those who do manage to get through, sometimes without documents, sometimes what we call an irregular migration, they're afraid to leave and try again. So they feed the problem, they live underground, they do the very things that cause the host country to feel impatient and angry with them. So they impose more penalties, which makes it even less likely that they'll go home. What IOM has been saying for some time is that migration should always be safe, it should always be legal, and it should always be secure for everybody. In fact, we'd like to see border checks. We'd like to see governments taking responsibility for who's coming in and out of their country. But if you have that and there's no penalty for staying and coming to work, and you can go home freely and come back again later, you do get, I think, the rotational migration that the US enjoyed very much in the past century and doesn't enjoy anymore. And you don't have the problem of a growing underground community that has to be rooted out.
So, primarily the migrants in this particular case were from Somalia and Ethiopia, I understand. Were these mostly single male workers? Were there families? Were there women and children?
There are many more Ethiopians and Somalis, which is typical on this route. There are other ways to get to the peninsula from Somalia. But they were actually rather young, as we understand it. They were almost young men. The average age 16 is what I've been hearing.
Average age 16? Oh my goodness, that's children.
Very, very. Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe average isn't correct. Maybe the majority are around 16, because average would indicate that there were probably some 10-year-olds, and I don't think there were anybody that young. But they were definitely on the young side. They were definitely male. We haven't heard about any families or women on this, as you do in other parts of the world.
And so, what has happened to those who did die? Bodies recovered? I mean, where were they returned to their families? Do they end up simply being buried in Yemen?
We found 27 buried in very shallow graves. We found others we've been able to treat with first aid and food and water. We understand that there are several, probably a few dozen, that have already begun their movement towards their destination. They declined any kind of help to turn back around. We would not ordinarily, IOM would not ordinarily be involved in any kind of resettlement. That would be other agencies that would take care of that. Our position would always be to give first aid right on the scene and then get as much testimony as we can. And I believe we've done that. But those survivors that some of our people have talked to, we've heard that they're extremely determined to continue their journey, which sounds a little incredible, but actually, when you see what they've gone through already, you can understand why someone wants to make a success out of this journey, not to be turned back even now.
And so most of them are going to Yemen, which is, as you said, a war-torn nation. We know that there's been a brutal Saudi and US-backed war, UAE-backed war in Yemen right now. So the idea is that a lot of the smugglers are promising they can take advantage of the chaos of war to get these migrants there. But then their final destination, is it Europe or is it just elsewhere in the Gulf?
No, it's in the Gulf. The final destination on this route tends to be Saudi Arabia or one of the Gulf Emirates.
Where there's a
It
big
is
demand for
not.
migrant labor, right?
Yes, I mean, we understand that Ethiopians alone, there might be 500,000 in Saudi Arabia, and that I think 100,000 in the last year have availed themselves of an amnesty to go back and not be punished. And I believe there's even opportunities to get a small stipend to reestablish yourself at home. But of course, There's drought conditions affecting Ethiopia right now. There's political issues across the Horn of Africa. It's not a very welcoming place for a young person who wants to advance their life in the workforce. And the the oil economies are booming even under low prices of today. There's just a lot of demand. There's a lot of history involved in employing outsiders to work and make the kingdoms function, which
What
they
a,
do. It's as irresistible as farm workers in the U.S.
right. So what, in fact, so what are the jobs that they're mostly going to? Is it construction labor, the construction labor?
Construction, janitorial, car washing, car watching, a lot of informal things, a lot of domestic labor, women especially in the domestic household workforce. Of course, they're not by any means good jobs, but you probably can save almost all that you're paid, especially if you're working in a home and have a place to sleep and food provided, however meager. And these are absolutely, there doesn't seem to be any shortage in demand for, this is a pretty recession-proof kind of work because people born in the kingdom aren't very unlikely to do these kinds of jobs, have been for years, so those will be available to them. And that's sort of the problem. We all over the world, consumers want migrants to arrive. They just don't want to be reminded of them and how they got there when they're there. And so that creates kind of a reaction that leads to punishment, and punishment leads to more coming secretly and staying and hidden. And then that, of course, feeds on itself.
What, who is responsible then for them? I mean, if these are people whose lives are at horrific risk en route, is it international waters that they're in when they've drowned? Who is to be held responsible in terms of some kind of government or even international body?
That's a good question. We are working with member states. There are shareholders. There are partners everywhere in the world. And of course, we are responsible, and so are they equally. I would say, I mean, that's why we lobby for, as I said earlier, safe, legal, and secure migration. There is no, there is, there are, of course, consular officials from the various countries, especially countries that have the resources like India that do a pretty good job of monitoring the workforce. All over the world and make sure that their people are treated humanely. Usually what happens is the smallest and poorest countries lack the resources for that kind of vigilance. I mean, we've heard stories of over 29,000 people just from Bangladesh dying abroad, mostly in the Gulf region over the last decade and a half. And some Bangladeshi diplomats have told me that it's their countries and Nepal, for example, very small, very weak countries compared to the larger ones like India, that can afford to monitor the treatment of their people and insist on certain quality. So in that respect, the governments do, and even Ethiopia and Kenya and other governments like that often try to impose sanctions and curb the illegal recruitment of workers or the mistreatment of workers or bad practices, but they're limited to how much they can actually do to fight for their citizens' protection. So we understand that most actors in the world are trying to act responsibly, but it's a big world and people are scattered, thousands of miles from home. It's not an easy thing to pull off.
Joel, does the International Organization for Migration, your organization, does it accept donations from individuals? How can people, here in the United States and our viewers, contribute?
Well, we do have USAIM, which is our U.S. philanthropic arm. We have a website where, of course, donations are welcome. I mean, we really are. We're a 65-year-old organization. We're not an NGO. We do work with governments. Governments contract us to identify a problem and then try to solve it. So a lot of our fundraising is done in-house in projects that governments that are our members would like to see done. And usually they go. Smaller countries will go to, let's say, the EU or the USAID or DFID of the UK and raise as much money as they can. But of course, individuals can always contact us and make contributions where they're quite welcome here.
And the website is?
Well, IOM.int, that's where you can find us.
We'll post a link to that from our website later today. Joel, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too. I'm speaking with Joel Millman. He is the press officer at the Department of Media and Communications at the International Organization for Migration. And we've been discussing the story of hundreds of primarily Ethiopian migrants being pushed into the Yemen Sea. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.